You're listening to a Comics XF podcast.
Lazowitz, and welcome to this week's episode of Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast, where each week my co-host Will Nevin and I dig into three Batman stories, discuss them, and rank them on the big board, thus creating a giant list of Batman stories from best to worst. Will, what's going on tonight?
I have had a goddamn day, Matt. So I woke up this morning with a little pinch of a headache, turned into a migraine, which was super fun. I know. And then I was getting my hair done today. I go in and it's a new person. I don't like change. I don't like new people. And to top it all off, and look, I understand that people in service industries are people, right? My stylist is a person. I still don't want to make conversation. I don't want to talk. I just want to sit there. And she's very friendly, right? She's meeting a brand new client, had a bunch of questions for me. Me having a migraine wanted nothing to do with it. So I was kind of an asshole the entire time. But again, migraine, everything was bad. So I came home, I canceled class, I slept, finally coming out on the other side of it. It was a rough day. And going back to last week, man, it's been a couple of episodes here for me.
You sound less stuffy, at least.
Yes. Enjoy that, editing that episode, Matt, when you get to it. But yeah, I'm feeling good, feeling strong. This morning when I was trying to read for the show, like I couldn't even like bear to look at the iPad to read the books. So I am in a much better place. It was a goddamn day, Matt.
Well, glad to hear that you're doing better. Now, because you were down, I doubt you saw the announcement DC made for the miniseries launching in July.
Robin Lives?
Oh, you did see it.
I did see it just before I came in. I was looking at some headlines, and yeah, I like the writer, right? DeMatteis.
Yeah, Rick Leonardi is the penciler is, you know, he's an 80s, 90s, you know, headliner, had a long run on Nightwing, so he's got that chops. I'm excited to see what they do with that little alternate universe for four issues.
How long can you keep Jason in a coma?
Probably not long. I'm expecting Jason to be out. The question is, how long before he goes Red Hood, even if he's not, you know, actually the Red Hood using the name? How long before he, you know, starts hunting the Joker for sport?
I mean, who wouldn't hunt the Joker for sport? Aside from Batman.
Fair point. But yeah, that was an interesting bit of news.
Oh yeah, I thought so. Let's do more weird stuff, more what ifs and explorations, not just little one-offs. Let's really get in there, dig into it. I think four issues, it sounds like a good number right there.
And when you get the chance to look at the article, the Mignola cover on it.
Oh, I saw that cover. It's a good cover.
Yeah. I mean, he did those covers on the original Death in the Family. So I was like, okay, he's coming back. And it's, I mean, much more in his modern style, but still quality looking cover.
To be Mike Mignola and just be able to just pick whatever work you want. DC comes to you and say, hey, we're doing a Robin Lives mini. You want to do a cover for it? And he's like, sure.
But you were able to read the books, so I assume we can, you know, jump into this week's episode, unless you have anything else.
No, I do not have anything else. I struggled through the first arc, so my thoughts in it might be a little bit more begrudging, but the reading tonight was nice and smooth and easy, even if it's from an era, which I'm rapidly learning. When it comes to bat books, it was just a very bad time.
Oh, yeah. That middle period, that is not a good... Yeah, we'll get to that. That's definitely the second story that is from one of the roughest periods in the Bat books in my 30 plus years of reading Bat titles.
Yeah, this is not good. But hey, we'll get there.
Fortunately, that one was only one issue.
Thank God.
Always a plus. But this week, we've read so much sort of around her. Thought it was time for us to do an episode focusing on Stephanie Brown and focusing on her in all three of her incarnations. So we're reading a story of Steph as Spoiler, one as Robin, and one as Batgirl. The first story of the night is Inquiring Minds. This is Detective Comics Volume 1, numbers 647 to 649. The writer is Chuck Dixon, with pencils by Tom Lyle, inks by Scott Hanna, colors by Adrian Roy, letters by John Costanza, and edited by Denny O'Neill and Scott Peterson. The cover dates are August and September of 1992. Cured of his pathology, the Clue Master is back in Gotham and just wants to make some money. But someone is still sending clues to the GCPD and Batman. Who is this mysterious new figure calling herself Spoiler? First off, just as we always do, problematic creator watch for Chuck Dixon. Dixon is a known hardcore supporter of many right-wing political causes. So, not someone we would want to have dinner with.
No, not someone we want to have on the show.
No. So obviously from that description, this is the first appearance of Stephanie Brown. And this is the first appearance of the Clue Master in many, many years. As let's be fair, dude is a C-rate Riddler.
And that's interesting that his first appearance in years, because he pops up, and I think the readers just sort of expected to know who he is and know what his deal is, and that it's something new and novel that he's not, sending off clues constantly.
Which is funny from an era where we're so used to there being so much exposition. I will rephrase, this is his first Batman appearance in a number of years. He was over in a group of D-listers, a sort of a D-list Injustice gang who ran up against the Giffen DeMatteis Justice League, the comedic Justice League. So they were a similarly low-rent Injustice gang, but he hadn't been in a Bat book for 6 years. And before that, it had been 5 years in between that appearance and his one before that. So this is a character who very much was a minor figure.
And this is Stephanie's first appearance.
Yeah.
We learn nothing about her.
No, and it feels like there are so many little details and hooks set up because you see this version of her mother who appears for one page. Stephanie gets a name and is really just a plot hook. She's there to be angry at her dad. That's all she does in this story. She
And we
will.
don't even know why she's angry so much.
You're, I guess, meant to assume, oh, he was a crappy dad because, he was a super villain. But there's not a lot of exposition. This is also very early in Dixon's time as a Bat writer. This is only his second arc on Detective and his third or fourth Batman arc, period. Because he would have done the first Robin miniseries, the follow-up Ghost Boxes that we covered, then Robin 2, this would be his fifth, and then his first arc on Detective. So he's got less than 12 issues of Batman in his pocket at this point for a writer who's going to become one of the principal architects of the Batline for the next 7 years. We're really early in his time as a Bat writer.
I certainly didn't think that this was bad. It's just striking how little character development that we have for Stephanie. Like Batman, and maybe she says this herself, but I know specifically Batman frames her as being out for revenge. And That's such a strong motivation, but it's not developed at all. And like you said, we're just supposed to assume that he was a crappy dad, and who could have gotten a taste of that?
When she enters the New 52, at least there we get, the beginning of Eternal, and we understand what it was about Cluemaster that made her so angry. Here it's just, he's been in jail and had amnesia, which, that's a convenient trope.
And he's such a, you called him a low rent Riddler. He sure is. Motherfucker loves to talk, loves to explain his little gadgets and his gizmos and his plans. Shut up.
He never becomes much. He will show up in a few arcs in Robin, mostly so Stephanie has an excuse to put on the costume again and team up with Tim early in like the first arc of the Tim Drake ongoing. And then he'll show up once or twice again in that series, and that's about it. And then War Crimes, but again, better, less said about that, the
Boo.
better. He
And
never,
apparently gets blowed up in Suicide Squad.
yep, he never becomes much of anything. While Stephanie becomes a much more fully developed and integral character, he remains lukewarm. I think the best Cluemaster stories are actually New 52 into the Rebirth stuff, Eternal, and then when he pops up in Batgirls. At least he's doing something there versus, again, just being second-rate Riddler.
Aha, I have tarred you with epoxy. Ah.
I don't know if that's so much him as a character or Dixon not quite having the way to write a bat book down. Because, again, before this, Dixon didn't have a ton of credits. I mean, again, this is 92. He really started writing comics in the mid 80s, but that was indies and Conan and stuff like that. His first real mainstream DC Marvel work was some Moon Knight in 89 and some Punisher in 90. So he'd only been in mainstream comics for a couple years. Listen, I have any number of reasons that I disagree and personally dislike Chuck Dixon. His bat stuff tends to read real easy.
Oh, it does. It
His,
does.
he is a very competent writer, to at times a good writer, but this is clunky and early, I think.
Yeah, it's got some rough edges to it. Not terribly rough, not rough to the point of I gotta put this down or this is boring me to death. But even some of the basic beats here aren't great, right? Spoiler shows up and then she's, swinging a brick at Tim. And then in the very next issue, they're working together. Like Batman's happy to, well, not happy, but, he's willing to, accept her into whatever this is. And so that, this probably needed another issue for some of that development and for the team up to feel a bit more natural. But again, not terrible.
No, there are some clunky moments that at the end of part two, when Tim brings Steph to meet Batman and he seems willing to kind of accept her, they say that Cluemaster's plan is going to happen tomorrow. We begin issue three with them seemingly in the same position, and now it's, oh, it's going down in an hour. It just felt like inconsistencies in the scripts that an editor hadn't caught and that Dixon hadn't thought about, that he realized that he had set up the plot and realized that, oh, it can't be a day because if I did that, Batman would be ready for him. It has to be right now. But crap, the issue's already been lettered and I can't adjust it.
Well, Matt, you have to have your big climactic late night shopping mall telethon fight.
Do you remember the Jerry Lewis telethon?
I do not, but I remember it as a concept.
Yeah, I don't think I ever watched one, but again, I remember it existing. I remember it being on, and
Just like shopping malls.
I remember telethons, but they are not a thing that happens anymore. And shopping malls aren't really, you're not going to have a big grand opening of a shopping mall that will bring
Ugh.
in $2 million in contributions to charity.
I wonder what was the last mall that opened? The last great indoor mall, what would you say? 90, 98, 99, 2000 maybe?
Somewhere in that area. Yeah, because I remember ordering books from Amazon as almost a novelty in the late 90s. And Borders started to really collapse in on itself around 07, because Amber and I weren't quite married when I think Borders started to close, and we were married in 08. And I think over the course of like 07, 08, 09, Borders just died. And that was the, and maybe that was because I worked at a Borders for so many years that it's the one that sticks in my head. But that is the first like big chain that I felt overextended itself and just collapsed. And not the first ever, but in this wave of these things happening. Because yes, I mean, Gimbels and all that, we've seen things, but those were put out of business by competitors in the brick and mortar space. Borders is the one that went out of business because they extended too fast and Amazon took them apart. It is a wild ending to see this big plot that doesn't work, would not work today with a caper, a heist at a mall, in a telethon at a mall, an opening. All of these things are just not things that happen anymore. I don't think you would be able to get $2 million in cash by robbing every store in a mall on Black Friday in the year of our Lord 2024.
Oh, okay. If we went to one of them really big regional malls, the ones that are still almost kind of doing okay.
Yeah, there's the King of Prussia Mall out here, the Mall of America, one up in the New York. Right on the border, the northern border of New Jersey with New York, that has a big old IMAX theater. Yeah, I guess there are some of that would, but most of them,
Oh, no.
we're not even in a cash business world anymore. I think it was a good point you made about just how little is going on with Stephanie here. And what I can't figure out is, part of me feels like that was because she was created just as a part of this arc. And so, why would you need to give her any background? Because you didn't think you'd ever bring her back. Because she was just here because you wanted to tell this story about the daughter seeking revenge on her father. But if that's the case, why do you have one page of her and her mom who's strung out on prescription medication? Why do you have that detail for a character you don't expect to ever bring back? I can't, for the life of me, figure out what would have been going on there. And she won't show up again for a year and a half. It's not like this is a character who comes back in a few months. You have to get all the way through all of Nightfall and all the run-up to Nightfall, because she would come back in Robin like two or three, which overlaps with the beginning of Night Quest. So it's a ways.
Range.
Yeah, she's an engaging enough character as a concept, but doesn't have a ton of personality. And I also think it's very clear from this and the other two stories that we'll read tonight that the Stephanie we got in Eternal is a very different character. This Steph is not the girl genius hacker that was introduced in Eternal. She's very much an every woman, and she doesn't have all these the skills. She's learning, and she doesn't have Dick's acrobatics or Tim's genius. She's just, this is what happens when someone who just wants to get involved in this stuff tries, and that's how you get a war game.
You know what happens after War Games, Matt?
Oh, I do.
Nothing. Nothing. There was no follow-up to that story at all.
Let's be fair. I think if we skipped everything in between Hush and Under the Hood, just disappeared, very little of value would be lost.
You can cut Hush right in there too, Matt.
Hush gets Bruce revealing his identity to Selina. Granted, that could be done elsewhere.
J
Hush.
look, just like we can condense the prequels into a badass lightsaber duel over lava, we can condense Hush into like 3 pages.
Oh, you could take the 12 issues of Hush and cut it down to a really good 3-issue story.
That's still too much. That's too much. That's too much Tommy Elliot for anybody.
But I think you don't need much Tommy Elliot. I think you really, we need to cover the animated Hush because it does an animated Long Halloween where it completely changes the end. And I don't know if it's better, but it's different. I just, Hush is pretty. The Jim Lee art is really, really nice. I like some of the Bruce and Selena beats in there. There is too much Tommy Elliot. Do not, I will never argue that point.
Look, a genius doctor like Tommy Elliot, a skilled heart surgeon, plastic surgeon, whatever other medical thing you need him to be in the story, Tommy Elliot would suggest no one needs that much Tommy Elliot.
Brain surgeon, because he was a brain surgeon in that one, because he needed to help relieve the pressure after Bruce fell off that building. He's been a brain surgeon, a heart surgeon, and a plastic surgeon because this is comics. And if you can do one thing, you can do them all.
God damn it.
One non-Stephanie related note here. This story is also the first appearance of Armand Kral, the soon-to-be mayor of Gotham. And I just like that feeling of building a world. We just don't get that as much anymore. It's all so
No, we certainly don't.
focused on the story that the writer wants to tell. It's so specific and so narrow that you're rarely building the wider Gotham. It is the thing about the 90s is that Dixon, Grant, and Mensch were all playing off each other and building a wider Gotham with characters and plot lines who appeared in multiple books. What I wouldn't have given for Tynion to have used Deb Donovan during Fear State.
Oh, that would
Things
have been
like,
good.
right,
M
things like
more
that.
Deb Donovan.
Yeah, I wish there was, and I say this knowing that I would not want Zdarsky or Williamson sticking their foot in the middle of the Rom V run right now. But there is something to be said for the three Bat books existing in conversation with each other. And more so in the Bat books than the Superman books, because right now, Williamson's Superman and the recently ended Philip Kennedy Johnson run at least felt like they existed in the same world. The three Bat books really feel very disconnected from each other.
Yes, very different styles and ideas and stories. But, and like we've always said, detective needs a mission, right? It needs to have a reason why it exists. And Rom V has certainly found that. It's going to be a big, big question of whoever follows him, are they going to be able to keep that kind of energy and that kind of book going? The one thing I'll say about this is that I liked having, we've seen this storyline play out in different points, but this little taste of, as you said, the wider Gotham. I like Batman as being constrained as an actor in a political system, right? I like that grounding because if Batman could just do whatever he wants in Gotham, if he just has free range to operate, it's less interesting, right? Rules and obstacles and things to overcome. Gordon having to play in this system. It's nice having rules and it's nice being in a real world situation bounded by rules.
I absolutely agree. But I think we've talked through this one.
Oh, that means it's time to put inquiring minds on the big board.
We are at 396 stories on the big board.
Let's see, 397. Now we're gonna have 399 when we're done tonight.
Who'd have thought we would have gotten this far?
I know.
The number one book on the list is the post-crisis origin of Batman, Batman Year One.
Still at a sexy 69, it's JLA Prometheus.
And still at 100 is the team up of Batman and the Golden Age Green Lantern, made of wood.
Made of wood.
At 200 is Super Heavy, the Jim Gordon and Batman armor story. At 300 is Grounded, the first issue of the Batman Beyond animated tie-in ongoing. And 396, speaking of Stephanie Brown, is War Crimes.
Boo.
All right, so let's see where else we have some Dixon. This is not going to fall in the top 100. There's a few spots in there. Getting out of that area, I don't think this quite is as good as 119, which is a Bullet for Bullock, the Harvey Bullock one-off. I like that story. That's it. I don't like this one.
I read this as something just perfectly average. And to me, I think right around perfectly average at this point means about 200.
Yeah, another Dixon story, and frankly, one that I don't know if it's better, but I like it more, is Brotherhood of the Fist at 203. I just like all the monkeys. I think that's.
Oh, look. There was more thought that went into the ordering of the monkeys than I think anything we have in this story.
I think probably we're in the two teens.
I
Because
like that.
I think 206, similar with the Misfits, which is bringing back a bunch of C-list Bat Rogues. But again, I think Alan Grant really thought out a lot more of that, even if the end is a bit rushed. I'd probably put this above Idiot Root at 215. How about 211, right above the Mud Pack, the multi-Clayface story?
Too many clay faces. I agree.
All right, the new 211 it is. Our second story of the night is And Red All Over. This is Detective Comics Volume 1, number 796. The writer is Anderson Gabrich. The pencils are by Pete Woods. Inks by Nathan Massengill. Colors by Jason Wright. Letters by Clem Robbins and edited by Bob Schreck and Michael Wright. The cover date is September of 2004. Mr. Zazz is loose in Gotham again, claiming more victims. Batman is hunting him, but the new Robin, Stephanie Brown, may prove as much a hindrance as a help in hunting the killer.
And this is why this story is trash.
Because Batman should have just sent her home. Why in the world? Batman, how many times in this story does Bruce almost send her home and then was like, wait, no, okay, one more clue, one more thing. You've made it clear that she isn't ready for this.
And if she's not ready, why is she here?
Yeah, exactly. And why did you take half an hour for her to go and put on an armored costume when Zaz is out there killing people? You just wasted half an hour. That victim that they find in the subway tunnel, if Bruce hadn't waited to let Stephanie change costumes, that person might still be alive. Not well thought out, but just spoiler alert for a bit later, still the best story we've read by Anderson Gabrich.
Yeah, I don't really want to read any more.
There's not much left.
Good,
His
good.
run on Detective is less than a year, and we've covered about half of it.
Good. Emotionally, this book was just all over the place, especially in the relationship between Batman and Stephanie Brown Robin. His scolding, he's surly, she is chatty and when she's not chatty, she's, or when she is chatty, she's asking just like weird questions, and like the tone of this thing is just all over the place. It's not an enjoyable read.
I'm going to state this. I like Stephanie as a character. I think she's an interesting character. I love how she and Cassandra play off each other. I love how she and Tim play off each other. I love, when written right, how she and Bruce play off each other. The era of her as Robin is one of the low points in Batman comics because no one writing at that point felt like they liked Bruce Wayne as a character.
No.
Because they make it clear in this story, Barbara pretty much says it to him. The only reason he took Stephanie on as Robin is because Tim's dad found out he was Robin, said you couldn't be Robin anymore. Tim agreed, and Bruce just got whiny and was like, well, okay, if you're not going to be Robin, I'll make your girlfriend, your ex-girlfriend, Robin. How do you like that? It's so petty. And it's why you get a War Games, because Bruce didn't prepare her. He didn't train her right. He accepted someone into that position who wasn't ready for it. And then when that became abundantly clear, he just kicks her to the curb. And it's out of character for him. You can have Batman be a cold ass. It's not an interpretation of the character I like, but it is an interpretation of the character that you can have foundational reasoning for. No reasoning in any story tells me that Batman would be willing to take on a Robin who he really doesn't think is competent enough to be Robin, to show up.
Especially after Jason, right? He knows the consequences of having a Robin who is not prepared.
Right.
And not
And
to say that Jason wasn't prepared, but he knows that this is a deadly job.
right, he's spent years telling Stephanie she wasn't ready to be spoiler, and now he's taking her on as Robin. I doubt we are ever going to get around to reading the issues of Robin where Stephanie is Robin. That would have to be a Patreon request because they're not great. They're not even good. Because again, it's the same era. But throughout that whole run, he just treats her like this. It's not fun to read.
Like, who wants a Batman and a Robin who argue the entire time, and where Batman is constantly putting Robin in her place, who's constantly patronizing her? Bleh.
And can you imagine, this is them running up against Zaz. Zaz is a threat, don't get me wrong. What if this was Two-Face? What if this was Joker? Reading this, you absolutely can see, looking at War Games and saying, yeah, Batman got her killed. For someone who, and Lord knows this is pop psychology, for someone who has father issues, thanks to Cluemaster, the father figure who is cold and removed and then pushes her away, she is going to act out. And there's no way Batman doesn't know that. The main difference between this and most of the other Gaybridge that we've read is that there are a couple of actual pluses to this, none of them involving Stephanie, unfortunately.
And none of them really involving Gaybridge, because the only thing that really worked for me in this is the art.
Yes. The black and white with the one character in color who is the one Zaz is stalking.
Zaz Vision.
Yes, and that's done in a few other artists over the years. I can't remember if this is the first time we've seen it, but it's definitely early in how we've seen it. I think it's hinted at in the origin story that he's given in Batman Chronicles, but I like that. I also like that Zaz is a physical threat, which is something we saw when he showed up in Last Arkham and in Nightfall, and is often sort of forgotten because he's often just, knife wielding lunatic who's, stabby stabby all the time. Here, he and Bruce, it's an actual hand-to-hand combat fight. And he winds up dislocating Bruce's shoulder. He's a physical challenge. And there aren't a ton of villains who are that. So it's nice to see that used.
I would like to read more Zaz because I love Grounded. I love Simple. I love Basic. He's just a guy who loves killing. No
There's.
gadgets, no big intricate plots. Just like, I'm just a fucking serial killer.
There are some other good Zaz stories. There's, well, the origin in a Batman Chronicles, it's three different shorts about three different villains, and one of them is the Zaz origin by Grant. There's a Dini and Dustin Nguyen Streets of Gotham story that I remember being good. The problem is that Zaz is also one of those characters who can be very easily miswritten
I can
because
see that.
he is that killer, but he's also clever in the same way that people can write Bane as just this muscle bound, he swells himself up and just beats on Batman. Zaz can be written as just this cackling maniac who, again, just charging people with a knife and who doesn't have this pathology that everyone is sort of a drone, a robot, and he is the only one who's real. He's a textbook sociopath. And those are the stories that make him interesting. And if you just make him stabby guy, you could write any villain to be a guy who chases Batman with a knife. You want to make him a little more interesting than that.
Absolutely.
McFarlane Toys today released a pre-order for, I think, the first Zaz action figure. Right out of Nightfall with the crazy eyes and the scars and everything. I was like, oh, I might have to order that.
Does it come with like different arms and torsos with different numbers of scars?
That would be a nice touch. Yeah, we'll have to do a Zaz-centric episode soon. There's material there. And then we get to the end of this story. And if this was a longer arc, if Stephanie's evolution as Robin was something that we really had time to explore, then the fact that she nearly kills Zaz and doesn't necessarily have much remorse for that, there's potential for that to be an interesting story. But do you know how long Stephanie was Robin?
Couldn't have been more than a couple of months, right?
Yep. She gets the costume in Robin number 126, and she is out of costume, and Batman fires her in 128. She is Robin for 3 months.
And it's such shit at the end of this issue too, right? So Batman gives Zaz a headbutt. And then he later argues, well, you smashed his face into a wall. Had I not already broken his nose, it would have sent his nose, up into his brain and killed him. To me, I'm like, well, you didn't have to headbutt him in the first place, right? That's inherently dangerous and deadly. That just seemed like such a convoluted argument too at the end, where I had to flip back and figure out where exactly did she use deadly force?
If you were going to tell this story and you wanted to make that point, there's a knife. She
Yeah, should have just stabbed him.
stabs him in the back to get him to let Bruce go. And then did you think about where you were stabbing him? If you had stabbed him 3/4 of an inch to the right, it would have gone right into his heart. He would have bled out right then. There were way less convoluted ways to tell that story. And that's a story that you want to develop. That's not a one-off. And not in the same month that she gets fired. This is the same month that she is relieved of the costume over in Robin.
This is such bad editorial.
Not only do the writers not seem to like Bruce, there's a streak of misogyny in how Stephanie is treated. I'm not necessarily saying it's
Absolutely.
I'm not saying it's necessarily intentional, but it is, oh, let's make the girl useless and helpless. And it's not the worst Stephanie Brown story either, but sadly, there aren't really any good Stephanie as Robin stories, so I just picked one that was short and
Smart.
one that I remembered having nice art. I remember the whole Zaz shtick in here. And as you said, Zaz is a cool character. But this whole era was handled very poorly. And I don't like speaking conspiratorially about rumors you hear amongst comics gossip and attributing things to that. But we are at this point sort of in the height of Dan Didio as one of the guiding forces of DC. Like he is in ascent at this point. And Didio had a real negative vibe when it came to sidekicks, did not like them, regularly was trying to kill off Nightwing, and it never worked. I've heard him speak at cons about what a horrible idea he felt Oracle is. Why does Batman need someone? He's the world's greatest detective. Why does any detective at a in anywhere have someone they call and go, "Hey, can you run this license plate for me?"
Why did you ever need Watson, right? Holmes could have just done everything himself.
Right. And I just feel like this reeks of that anti-sidekick vibe. I do not like the way that the first in continuity female Robin is a failure intentionally. It's not good.
I'm done talking about it, Matt.
So am I.
That means it's time to put Anne Red all over on the big board. Sub 300.
Yeah. But I don't think this is da I mean, again, the other Gabrich stuff is War Games and then The Surrogate at 392 and War Crimes.
Oh, Christ, the surrogate was so bad.
Yeah, this is not quite down there.
Jesus, no more Gabrich. Ugh.
There is very little left.
There better be.
I'm thinking no higher than the 350s.
Yeah, th 350 seemed about right to me. Because again, a lot of this is just bad, but it's not awful. It's not terrible. It's not wretched, right? Like we get, God, Surrogate, so bad.
This is not actively offensive. There is
No.
no specific language in here that is offensive. Again, there is that streak of misogyny, but if you read this out of context, not knowing all the other stuff going on with Stephanie, it reads not necessarily as misogyny, just as that's what her character is. She's the screw up who Batman is working with.
All right, it is better than Robin and Batman at 371.
Like, I'm looking right in the 350s.
Okay.
I mean, I think as much as it wasn't an essential story, we didn't need it to appreciate all the other stuff. I think I would probably reread Daedalus and Icarus, the explanation of how Jason Todd came back from the dead, before I'd read this again. But I don't think I would read Crossworld, that first New 52 Batman and Superman story at 360, before I reread this. So I think this is somewhere in between 354 and 360.
How about the new 358, right above Bruce Wayne and Bialya?
Yeah, I was looking at that because In Darkest Night is clunky. But at least there's some neat ideas, and the Jerry Bingham art is pretty.
It's got that cover.
Yeah. And our final story of the night is Batgirl Rising, Point of New Origin. This is Batgirl Volume 3, numbers 1 to 3. The writer is Brian Q. Miller, with pencils by Lee Garbett and Trevor Scott, inks by Scott and Sandra Hope, colors by Guy Major, letters by John J. Hill, and edited by Michael Siglaine and Harvey Richards. The cover dates are October to December of 2009. In the wake of Batman's death, Gotham is in chaos, and Cassandra Cain has walked away from the role of Batgirl. But Stephanie Brown has decided to take up the mantle to Barbara Gordon's disapproval and has gotten involved in a case involving the lawless quarter of Gotham called Devil's Square and the new street drug, Thrill. This is obviously the beginning of Stephanie's tenure as Batgirl. The Batgirl Rising is 4 3-issue arcs that make up the first year of that series. This is Point of New Origin, then each of the others has a specific subtitle. So while this is mostly complete, there's a lot of things here that are obviously introduced to be fleshed out as this arc and this series rolls on. This was very much viewed by Miller, the writer, as a long-form project. And he writes this book from one till whenever it ends, somewhere in the early 20s, when the New 52 just kills it.
Oh, to have been a comic book reader at the start of the New 52. What a bummer.
Oh, you have no idea. The number of series that just sort of ended, that the number of books that there were plots that were just not wrapped up. And fortunately, they let Morrison come back and do a Batman Inc. in the New 52 that, while screwy in continuity, at least wrapped up a lot of those dangling plot threads. But Batgirl at least got a final issue that felt like a final issue. Red Robin and Birds of Prey just felt like they kind of ended. Or Teen Titans, that a few issues earlier had gotten a new creative team and they had a whole page that was, you know, coming soon in Teen Titans, and next to none of it got fleshed out. Because a lot of these writers were told that their books were ending with little to no warning. It was really sucky. I really like this run, this whole series, because it does the slice of life superheroics thing where you've got this character who is living a life and you're getting almost as much of Stephanie at school, Stephanie with her mom, Stephanie and Barbara and what's going on with her as you do the superheroics. It's a little bit of the soap opera with the superhero, and that can also not work. But I feel like in this book, and it might be because in retrospect, I can look at it as a whole, I feel like it really does work.
And we spend enough time with each of the characters to feel like we have some kind of emotional investment. Like, I'm curious to see where the Detective McDreamy, like, I want to see where he goes.
This book feels in some ways like a forerunner of the recently sadly ended Conrad and Clunan Batgirls book that was Babs, Steph, and Cass. This book, yes, it is Steph's book, but Barbara has a big role to play. And you only get a little bit of her, but Wendy, the daughter of the calculator, has a part to play. And Saint Nick, Detective Gage, has a part to play. Stephanie has a large ensemble surrounding her. And they're all, as you said, pretty well-rendered characters. And there's a little bit of the mess here in that we're not seeing some of the other stuff going on. The stuff about Devil's Square is stuff that comes out of Battle for the Cowl. So that isn't just, oh, by the way, there's this lawless section of Gotham. That is stuff that existed out of Battle of the Cowl. And why is Babs living in this crappy apartment with server towers? That's explained at the end of Birds of Prey Volume 1 and the Oracle Battle for the Cowl miniseries. We are kind of thrown into the middle of some of that stuff, but I don't think any of it is so jarring as to throw you terribly out of the book.
No, the things you need are here. They really are.
And by this point, Stephanie has had so much time to build as a character. She's a very likable protagonist. She is trying to get her life together, but still feels that the call of this life, and she is struggling with it. She wants to do right by her mom and the promises she made, but she also sees the way Gotham is, and she feels like she needs to help. That's classic teen superhero 101 writing, but it makes sense. And you've got her back. The reader has her back and
Yeah,
understands what she's going
absolutely.
through. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Now, her mother here, she can only have but one mother. Has this been retconned from that first appearance, or how is that working? Because she's a doctor now.
She's a nurse.
A nurse, okay.
Yeah, I believe if memory serves, she went to rehab during the original Robin run. I cannot remember how much they explain with her, but I mean, she was addicted to prescription opioids, and I think she got the help she needed and got her life back together at the time of Stephanie's death. Around that time. But it's been a while since I've read all that Robin stuff. Because again, we are 17 years from the time of that original story.
Couple of months in comics.
Yeah, exactly. Not too terribly long.
Yeah, I thought this was an enjoyable little story. Scarecrow feels a little crammed in here, right? I don't know that we need to be working with such a big bad. Like, we can just bust a campus drug ring, right? It doesn't have to involve Scarecrow.
It doesn't, but I think every bat has to have that rite of passage where they get exposed to fear toxin and face their greatest fear. And so I think that that's the thing that Miller was shooting for here, that you got to that point at the end. And Stephanie has been so full of doubt throughout this story that she has to face that down, and she has to face it down with Babs there listening in. So she can get that knowing smile and nod when Stephanie slugs Crane and says, "I'm Batgirl."
Solid moment.
Yeah, and Babs is, "Maybe you are."
Yeah.
This is the point where Babs is at one of her lowest ebbs, because right before Battle for the Cowl, the Birds of Prey disband, because she leaves Gotham after War Games. And the birds become sort of a mobile unit. And at the end of Birds of Prey, she's been having this whole thing with Calculator, who's become sort of her arch nemesis. And while she beats him, she kind of feels she's losing her edge and that she can't manage the birds. And so she comes back to Gotham. And then Bruce dies. And this is her dealing with Bruce's death. This is that period where we're a couple months after Final Crisis. So a lot of the books are these characters dealing with the loss of Batman. Dick is running around with Damian trying to take his place. Tim is sure that Bruce is still alive and is out there searching for evidence. And Babs is here just not wanting anything to do with any of them. And so it's nice to see Barbara, by the end of this story, bouncing back. And I really like that final interaction between her and Stephanie with the candle and the pledge. It's a moment that gets called back to a lot, the Robin and Batman making that pledge over the candle. And it's one that gets me most times, as long as it's handled properly.
Yeah. And it's nice to see Barbara making the pledge to Stephanie, right? That is a show of, all right, Barbara is important here, but this is Stephanie's book.
Completely agree. And we see throughout this book, Barbara calls her on it in a couple of places, that Stephanie, she's not quite as impetuous as the Stephanie who started the gang war, but she still needs a mentor. She still needs training. But especially in this book, Stephanie's heart is in the right place every time. She didn't go out looking for Scarecrow. She's stopping little crimes, and she's trying to find these guys who spiked the punch at a frat party. And it just winds up that, oh, those guys are working for Scarecrow.
Is working for Black Mask.
And this, and we won't even get here, this is the second Black Mask, as at this point, Sionis is dead. That's stuff we'll get to with Battle of the Cowl, Battle for the Cowl, and the ongoing Batman book at the time that dealt with the Black Mask stuff. Catwoman kills Black Mask. She kills Sionis right before 1 year later. And this is not the time to discuss this, but Selina, of all people, she gets a pass. She's killed numerous people, and Bruce always seems to give her a pass on that.
Look, it's hard to be critical of the people we love, Matt.
Also, absolutely agree on that one. Do you feel bad about it? Okay, you can kill a Black Mask every now and then. He's a really
shitty... If you have to.
He's a shitty guy. I'm not going to miss him. And yes, I mean, I can see where you're coming from with Scarecrow, but I really... That final sequence of her seeing Tim, her seeing herself as Spoiler... And fighting them is a really cool sequence. The art here is solid. It's very house style, but it's good. It tells its story. Garbutt does a good job with bodies in motion, which is always important for anything with Robins and Batgirls, since they all tend to be a bit more on the acrobatic side. I like the fact that they're using the Batcave. Because this is the point where Dick and Damian are in the tower in Batman and Robin. So Wayne Manor is abandoned at this point.
What is Alfred doing in space?
Well, he's with the Outsiders. He was just working with the Outsiders on missions. He was sort of their man in the chair and the guy telling them what to do. Bruce left that for him to run the Outsiders. It's a very short-lived sequence of events. Because it doesn't make sense, and he's better off being there as father figure for Dick and Damian than working with the Outsiders. That whole Outsiders, that particular volume was real messy, even before Bruce's death.
Hey, at least Alfred got to go to space.
That's true.
My final thought on this book is that a college freshman would not be in two 400 level classes.
I thought so. I was like, it seemed like that would be, especially a psych requirement, would have been a 101, wouldn't it? Usually?
Yeah. If I remember correctly, it was psych 480 and comp 480. I think whoever did that just pulled some numbers from somewhere, didn't think about it, didn't change them. So, yes, it was very much a freshman philosophy course, you know, talking about free will. And it factored into the story kind of cutely. But, yeah, no, those would both be 100-level courses.
Yeah, I was a bit befuddled by that. But that, yeah, I think that just struck me as, yeah, as you said, something with numbers. While Babs is hard on Stephanie here, nowhere does it read as brutal as Bruce was in that previous story.
No, not at all.
And Babs also has the additional reason of being protective of the identity of Batgirl. I think anyone who wears that costume would be in her shadow. And she chooses Cassandra. Stephanie, again, just kind of took the costume and was like, yeah, I'm going to be Batgirl. And I do like the moment where Steph is, you know, wearing the costume, then Babs just starts talking to her. It's like, what? You really didn't think I wired this costume? It was Cassandra's before you, right? It's a nice moment of just like, oh yeah, Steph just hasn't thought all of these little details out.
And she gets her own costume at the end. It's a good little arc.
It is, and I like this costume. I like the purple Batgirl costume that she has for the balance of this arc, this series. But yeah, I think that does it.
That means it's time to put Batgirl Point of New Origin on the big board.
For me, this is the best story of the night.
Yeah.
So Inquiring Minds is at 211. This doesn't crack the top 100, but it's probably somewhere in the mid 100s.
I would say player on the other side, 127 as a ceiling.
Yeah, it's definitely not higher than that. I think we're somewhere in the 130s. 130s or upper 140s, somewhere in that area. Low 130s, upper 140s. Let me throw a number at you.
Okay.
138. Below that Batman Green Arrow question annual event, above Trinity, the Wagner Trinity miniseries.
I like it.
Okay, new. So that makes it the new 138.
399 stories, Matt.
399. I mean, you think we're good, or you think we should do this for at least one more?
Let's do one more, at least.
Yeah, at least, who knows, maybe we could even get to five, but that's a ways off. But 400's gonna be next week. To celebrate and to get to 400, we're gonna go back and we're gonna return to an old favorite, three different anthology books featuring Batman stories. We'd like to thank our Patreon backers, Dan Grote, Josh Wheel, Mrs. Abigail Hartbaum, Asimov Fangirl, Tony Thornley,
Go Utes.
Sam Hopper, John Wickham, Robert Secundus,
Bobby Two Bucks.
Tim Rooney, Giorgio Sregioli, David Wheel, Alexander Wheel, Matt McThorne,
McThorny.
Dan Offer,
Barely knew her.
and Nate Randell for their support. This show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music slash Audible, Podbean, and on Comics XF, where new episodes drop every Thursday. You can support the podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/batchat with Matt and Will, where you can get shout-outs, bonus content, pick a story, and even come on the show.
And you come check me out on Twitter at Will Nevin, where I'm still wondering what the fuck a Podbean is. But until then, I'm out of here. Good night, Huntsville.
And be sure to visit ComicsXF at comicsxf.com or ComicsXF on Blue Sky and Twitter for our weekly Friday Bat Chat roundup of new Bat books. For my other show, the ComicsXF Interview Podcast, where my longtime best friend Dan Grote and I interview comics creators, retailers, publishers, journalists, and other related tradespeople, as well as all the other stuff Will and I are writing. And stay safe out there, folks. Gotham is not a place to be after dark.